So I'm Rick Hansen, it's March 4th, 2015, and I want to talk about dependable and undependable. In other words, over the last 6 months, I've had a number of experiences or situations in which conditions I thought I could depend upon, or people, turned out to be not so dependable. And I think one of the things that it's actually kind of hard to talk about, and we often don't really talk about, is the reality of undependability of so many kinds. There's the broad, in a sense, a loose sense, undependability of the body that's prone to aging and decay. Rust never sleeps. But beyond that, there's the undependability of organizations, arrangements, airline schedules, corporate commitments to funding their pension plans, healthcare systems, large-scale HMOs, et cetera, promises of delivering services in a timely way, accurate diagnoses, effective treatments. The third leading cause of death in America is medical error. That's actually true, after heart disease and cancer. So, a lot of undependabilities, realities, right? Powerful figures you thought already had enough money. Play the game to pile up more. And then there are people in our personal lives, right? People who said they would do something, they would come on time, they don't come on time. Then when you say to them, hey, I thought we had an arrangement, we were going to do this thing on the basis of which, I changed my plans, I stood there at that street corner waiting for you. And the other person says, oh, wow, I guess you're right. Okay, well, whatever, right? So besides not being able to depend on them to pick you up, you can't depend on them to actually repair it. And then when you say to them maybe something like, in our relationship, I like you, you like me, we're longtime friends, and there's this pattern, I think you're agreeing, that you make promises you don't deliver on, would you be willing to work inside yourself about that? Try to take it more seriously, or make sure you write it down in your day timer, you put it in your calendar on your phone, something. And they go, yeah, you're right, I really ought to do that. I'm going to practice inside myself about that. That would be a good thing. And then, inevitably, the next time, they blow it. And you say to them, what about that thing about you practicing internally to help yourself change or develop more of a healthy habit in this regard, coming on time? They're like, really? What? Oh, yeah. And you realize, wow, I got it. Can't do that. Or what if you're in a situation, and I'm speaking about situations I've been in recently, where you're in a relationship, maybe a family system. Let's say there's A and B and C and D. You're A, right? And B tells C something about you. B's mad at you for some reason. Okay? So B produces a justification to C. And C feels kind of weird about that. Like, really? Huh. But C doesn't tell you. And then a year later, when it comes out, C says, well, I thought you and B would work it out. But how could you work it out with B if you didn't know that B was making up that whole story, right? And then meanwhile, of course, C tells D. And then both of them are like, gee, do we really tell you or Rick? And then, a year goes by, and it's like, really? And this whole thing is just rippled through this complicated system, because what B said about you is completely absurd and has no basis in reality whatsoever, really. So there you are, right? And this kind of thing happens a lot, doesn't it? And it's interesting to think about our responses to it, because there's inherent in the transience of events, and certainly inherent in the passing, the impermanence of our own experience, there's a sense of kind of inherent unreliability. And then there are various forms of specific ways in which we can't rely on others, Or we rely on others and then they're not there to lean on. And the problem with that is it bumps up against our deep need as social mammals to rely upon each other and to imagine or predict that the other will actually be reliable. That's incredibly important for attachment relationships in early childhood. It's important for a child to imagine and predict that mom and dad will be reliable, dependable caregivers. They will be reliably emotionally available. They will be reliably committed to your welfare. They will reliably deliver the goods. They will fight through the tangles and brambles of the forest to find the damsel in the tower who will eventually let down her hair, Rapunzel, right? We need to feel that. You know, the great British child psychiatrist Winnicott had this line about kids', you know, fascination with hide-and-seek games. Peekaboo games, you know, hide-and-seek. Winnicott put it, a joy to be hid, a disaster not to be found. Right? We want to know that someone reliably will come and get us, you know? We'll leave no man or woman behind on the battlefield, for example, or in other situations. And so there's a collision, right, between the inherent nature of reality as passing and changing and entropy and rust never sleeps and the center does not hold, as the poet put it, and also, you know, the nature of our own experiences is passing. There's a collision between that, as well as the fact that a lot of people, frankly, are not very dependable. Let's tell the dirty little secret, you know, and they don't care. A lot, right? How do we deal with that fact, which is such a collision with our deep and very understandable need to have others to depend upon and to predict that they will be dependable? The brain is a big prediction machine. It's constantly predicting what will happen. You know, you reach for the cup, right? And you think that it's really full, so it's heavy. So because you predict that, your arm goes whoosh, like that, except it's only about a quarter full. Because somebody else drank the Kool-Aid before you got to it, and whing, oh, the Kool-Aid's flying through the air, you know, because reality didn't match our prediction. We're constantly predicting that others will be dependable, will be reliable. We can securely attach to them, and often we can't. What do we do about that? You recognize the real problem, right? It's a real issue, isn't it? And it's often one that we paper over. One way we deal with it is we try to not admit it to ourselves because we desperately want to believe in a world in which we can count on things. And we need to count on some things, right? Also, we don't want to create conflicts with other people. Also, we often don't want to let go of the hope that they'll be better next time. It'll turn out better. Or the next other person will be a more dependable worker, lover, friend, mate, parent, what have you, right? And yet, if we do that, if we deny what's actually true, you know, after we move beyond anger, after we move beyond resentments, we really see what's true. We really realize, wow, I'm tangled up in a net of, undependability here. What do we do about it? Now that have I thoroughly depressed you? I'm talking about your family system as well as mine, right? You know, and to be really clear, as this started happening to me, I started getting really interested in this matter of undependability, unreliability, and telling the truth about it. And what is a place of sanity and wisdom and Buddhist practice in this context tonight that gets beyond resentment, grievances, grudges, sustaining a case. I can't believe that airplane was 20 minutes late. So unreliable, United Airlines. You know, like getting beyond that silly stuff to the level of real. Wow. What are we going to do about it? So I want to offer what I think of as three refuges and then see what you think about all this. Okay. So the first refuge is to take refuge in disentangling oneself from relationships or obligation systems, responsibilities in which you honestly, best prediction of the future is the past, best predictor of the future is the past, in which, honestly, you probably can't routinely depend upon that person or that person for that thing or that person for that thing in that situation, something like that. And to take refuge in the willingness to name to oneself what's actually been the case. It's often poignant and hard to be disenchanted, to kind of wake up from the spell. Wow, you know why I haven't been able to count on you? Because I can't count on you. Because when the going got tough, you stopped going. Because you didn't step up for me. And the best predictor of the future is the past. You're probably not going to step up for me. It's to name it to ourselves. It's to push through the pain about that and to see what's actually the case. You know, to see the mosaic of the other person or the group or the institution or the situation. See the good. Don't deny the good because of the undependability or the letting down, the betrayal, the just can't do it. Just don't have the horses, that other person or institution, to deliver the goods. To see that part as well as, of course, the good, but to see the whole picture. And to, over time, take refuge in your own capacity to shrink the size of that particular relationship, maybe, to gradually shed those responsibilities to the scale where there's you actually have the resources to fulfill them. Other people are counting on you to carry a gallon, let's say, but you don't have a reliable gallon bucket. You only have a 3-quart bucket that has no holes in it. So you need to shrink the scale of what you're obligated around. Think about this interpersonally. If it's your job somehow to shore up another person's mood, you know, do you really have the resources to be able to do that, even though everybody's counting on you to be the one who does that? Maybe you don't have the resources to do that. Maybe you don't have the resources to actually, you know, discipline or restrain or direct a child in a system in which you're not being supported by a partner in a larger culture that, you know, teaches kids routinely how okay it is and, in fact, how cool it is to just completely blow off adult authority. Right? You don't have the resources to do your job. Well, you're let down. You see what I'm saying? But one of the refuges is to shrink the size of that responsibility space. And anything else you can think of. I mean, on my own side, I'm gradually working my way out of certain jobs, you know, because I realize, aha, often it's the best parts of us that form these childlike, deluded hopes about other people. This innocent longing for the good mother, the good father, the good brother, the good sister, the good friend, the good teacher, the good coach, what have you, the good boss, you know, projected out on the world. It's often that longing in us, a sweetness in us, an innocence. We look to ourselves. We go, wow, I'm dependable, basically. I guess you are too. Maybe. Not always so, right? So it's to, you know, be aware of that and recognize the sweetness of that goodness in oneself, but also recognize what is the truth. So that. Second refuge is to take refuge in your own practice. You know, one thing that really has kind of come for me when I sort of got past the uncomfortable part of all this, the sadness, the loss, you know, the anger of being let down. And I got past that. I realized that what I could count on, and it was up to me to be dependable about, was my own practice. You know, we can't make them practice, right? We can't make them practice right speech. We can't make them, you know, have some kind of larger sense of benevolence to the greater good, the greater whole. But we can do that for ourselves. And to take more seriously in a context in which so much in the world is, you know, just isn't that trustworthy in a lot of ways. We can trust in our own practice. You know, day by day, minute by minute, breath by breath, our time doing formal practice, meditation or prayer or other forms of practice we do, yoga, walking, some kind of practice, practices of insight, practices of virtue, of restraint, not stealing, not lying, not abusing sexuality or intoxicants, et cetera, et cetera. What's our own practice? We can take refuge in practice. I think about the, as you know, recent translations of the noble truths of the Buddha. The sense of them is not just noble, but ennobling. Taking refuge in the ennobling power of practice. And then the last refuge I want to mention here, and I want to use a reading to really illustrate it, is to take refuge in mind as a whole. And I don't mean anything cosmic or woo-woo or, metaphysical about that. I mean it really in terms of experience. To take refuge in mind as a whole. In other words, to take refuge in opening into this moment, because that's the only place mind exists, this moment, and all of mind, a sense of the wholeness or allness or totality of hearing, seeing, tasting, touching, and smelling, as well as thinking, emoting, wanting, remembering, imagining, and so forth, in this moment, mind as a whole. Because if you think about it, the things that are unreliable are always parts of the whole. But the whole itself is always reliable, because it itself is stable and unchanging. If you think of it this way, the ocean has many parts. Let's say it's waves on the surface, these swells rising and falling, each of them with its own pattern of foam and seaweed. And yet ocean itself, as ocean, is always ocean. Ocean is never not ocean. Ocean is always the same. Mind as mind is unchanging as mind, certainly as long as the body lives. And a way into that is kind of given in this really sweet book from Suzuki Roshi, who founded San Francisco Zen Center, was really instrumental in bringing Zen to the West. And also, one of his most famous books is Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. Right. So I want to read you a little passage that, more eloquently than I'm doing here, expresses this third refuge. And this talk was given, I think, in... when Apollo 11 was landing on the moon, the night it happened. Okay, so that's the larger context that Suzuki Roshi is giving this talk. And he says here, in meditation, we sometimes practice counting our breath. You may think it is silly to count your breath from 1 to 10, losing track of the count and starting over. If you use a computer, there will not be any mistake. But the underlying spirit is quite important. While we are counting each number, we find that our life is limitlessly deep. If we count our breath in the ordinary way, as we would count the distance from here to the moon, our practice doesn't mean anything. To count each breath is to breathe with our whole mind and body. We count each number with the power of the whole universe. So when you really experience counting your breath, you will have deep gratitude, more than if you arrived on the moon. You will not be so interested in something just because it is considered great, or uninterested in something usually considered to be small. Still, you may be very interested in having new experiences the way a baby is. A baby has the same basic attitude of interest towards all things. If you watch her, she will always be enjoying her life. We adults mostly are caught by our preconceived ideas. We are not completely free from the objective world because we are not one with the objective world. That's an incredible sentence. These Zen masters, can you believe it? We are not completely free from the objective world because we are not one with the objective world. Things change. For the usual person, this is very discouraging. You cannot rely on anything. You cannot have anything. And you will see what you don't want to see. You will meet someone you don't like. If you want to do something, you may find that it is impossible. So you will be discouraged by the way things are going. As a Buddhist, you are changing the foundation of your life. That things change is the reason why you suffer in this world and become discouraged. When you change your understanding and your way of living, then you can completely enjoy your new life in each moment. The evanescence, the transience, the impermanence of things is the reason why you enjoy your life. When you practice in this way, your life becomes stable and meaningful. So the point is to change your understanding of life and to practice with the right understanding. To arrive on the moon may be a great historical event, but if we don't change our understanding of life, we won't have much meaning. It won't have much meaning or make much sense. We need to have a deeper understanding of life. The only way is to enjoy your life. Even though you are practicing Zazen, counting your breath like a snail, you can enjoy your life, perhaps even more than taking a trip to the moon. That is why we meditate. The most important thing is to be able to enjoy your life without being fooled by things. Thank you very much, he says. All right. So what do you think of undependability and these three potential refuges in that which is more dependable? Disentangling yourself from undependability, doing your own practice, and opening out into the allness of this moment. Be the ocean, untroubled by the waves.
It's really wonderful to have you back. And I had been away before, so I haven't seen you in a long time. What it reminded me of was some of a big David Rico fan, and his book, The Five Things We Cannot Change. One of those five things is people will disappoint you. And I have to say, I found that quite profound when I read it, because I think I used to hold it as people disappointed me, like, on purpose, and if they really cared about me, they wouldn't. And I think this is kind of back into that, you know, being with what is, right? I mean, it's not necessarily personal, but to be in that place of allowing to stay with the practices that allow us to accept, even if it's painful, you know, to be able to do that.
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Appreciate that. Glad you're here too. Yeah, Sundara.
I have a question, if I'm understanding this correctly, because I'm in my brain applying it to specific things.
That's good.
And
concrete.
The first part, when you say disengaging, are you talking about from the person?
If,
is that what you were referring to?
Potentially.
Yeah.
Or, you know, don't put them out of your heart, but maybe realize that they're just never going to give you that thing you really want.
No cheese.
Yeah, no cheese in that tunnel, if that's true. And I think there's a place, as part of the disentangling, I should have said this, but I'll say it now. Sometimes it's really appropriate to name it to the other person in a kind of, however you do it, hopefully skillfully. But often I think we don't address unreliability, and then it becomes the new normal. And people think, oh, as long as I'm charming, everything's fine. Or as long as you're not ballistic, everything's fine. And, well, maybe it's not. And that's part of the disentangling, the first refuge. If it's appropriate and safe to name what's the truth, yeah.
Okay, so I'm in the second taking refuge in your practice in regard to how you deal with these things. Is that what you're saying? Or a part of your disengagement?
Thank you. So the refuge of practice, in part, is how we practice with the pain. And how we practice with loving them, wishing them well even, while saying goodbye, if that's what it is. Or seeing, part of what I think happens is that other people are, let's say, unreliable, undependable, and they genuinely are. There's a real issue there. So they hit the ball, as it were. And you know, you may know the definition of karma is hitting golf balls in a shower. you know, they come back, right? So they hit the golf ball this time. They're the one who agreed to X and didn't do it, or said they would never do Y again and they keep doing Y, whatever that might be. They're hitting that golf ball. But often what happens is they hit that golf ball and we catch it before it sails back toward them. We act like it didn't happen. We catch it. And sometimes practice is to let that golf ball sail back with equanimity. We can see it's their karma. It's their condition. It's the effect of their cause, including the way we're not going to pretend anymore that the relationship is like this when it's really like that. Right? We're not going to play that game anymore. And the trick in practice is to do these sorts of things with an open heart, a loving heart, with restraint, always checking yourself, you know, am I going overboard here? Because it's so easy to slip into self-righteousness and other forms of attachment to view in this regard, you know, and also to practice more generally, you know, to strengthen our own practice. I had a spiritual teacher. He said, without practice, this realm is hell. With practice, it's merely purgatory. But purgatory is better than hell. Okay, a few other folks, and okay, we have plenty of time. I'm in shock.
It's a great topic, and particularly poignant for those who've had primary caregivers who are very unpredictable.
Yeah.
And it seemed that this practice could cover that, but I'm wondering if there's anything extra in those situations that could not ease the retrigger of the trauma that you can't count on.
Yeah, if we grew up in situations, I'm doing a whole thing on attachment theory and dependability and so forth in the Foundations of Well-Being program. I invite you to check it out. It's kind of neat to do that in that framework. And you're right, if we have caregivers who were not reliable or nurturing in a way that would promote secure attachment, especially given our own level of neediness temperamentally, no fault on us. We were infants and toddlers and preschoolers at the time. You know, if that happens, you can develop this very internalized sense of unreliability. And partly sometimes what we can do is seek similar situations because they're familiar. And that's something to really watch. Am I being drawn to others, especially in important relationships, especially ones that kind of have a piece of the family puzzle, they're intimate or friendly or sexual, you know, or, yeah. Are we drawn to situations where, like Charlie Brown and Lucy, you know, with the football, you're going to get let down again, you know? And I think that's important to watch out for. And obviously a takeaway, too, is to think about our own dependability for others, you know? Can they depend on you, or can you depend on me to show up and be appropriate? So, seeing a lot of hands, yeah.
Yeah, it seems to me that the undependability of institutions borders closely on social injustice.
Yeah.
And it sounds a bit like sort of the message here is of disentanglement is close to accepting
injustice. Yeah. Exactly. Well, I'm glad you,
And I'd be interested in what your thoughts are about that.
I really appreciate that. Well, a couple examples, you know. Like a bank. So it shall be nameless. I've been with a bank a long time, a particular bank, and if you've ever gotten a check from me, you know what bank I'm talking about. And recently we were there and they set up a whole bunch of nice accounts for us for this business thing I'm doing. And as it turned out, all that was a complete mess. And we couldn't get our calls returned, literally. Like, what? And fairly quickly, we realized, aha, all this hooey about this bank is, you know, your best friend, trust us, you know, we love you, you're like a high status customer, you know, you run some businesses through this thing. Boop! You know, like, that's an example. So what do we do? Well, net, bottom line is probably still in our interest to deal with that bank because we have a lot of history there and there's a lot tied up, but aha, won't be fooled again, you know? That's an example. Right? Another example, obviously, is, you know, Congress and obvious politicization and extraordinary things that have happened in the last 30 years, especially accelerating in the last, you know, 8 or 6, that are just astonishing. And so I don't mean for myself, disentangling, like not voting or not sending money or not doing what I can, but I got to say it, you know, grinding away for me on political blogs past the point that I've learned anything new, just, oh, I can't believe they did that yet again. Well, they did it today and they did it yesterday and they're probably going to do it tomorrow. And what's the point of that's useful? So that's more what I mean. I don't mean countenancing it. I just mean, you know, seeing clearly and not having a childish or childlike hope.
But where does the notion of doing something about it come in? One thing, I mean, is there space within the disentanglement and understanding that, yes, this has happened in the past, it will likely happen in the future.
Yeah.
But then, where does doing something about it fit in with that? Do we have some obligation in a way, in a spiritual sense, to act in such a way that we do something about it?
Yeah, for sure. But to play with it a little bit, even to push back a bit, I think maybe potentially embedded in the question or the implicit in it is the presumption that if we're not entangled, we're not influential. And I think in many ways, we give up, we reduce our influence when we're entangled. And it's really possible, I think, to have a very clear-eyed view of what I can't count on and what that institution, let's say, corporate greed, you know, petrochemical companies. I just read about the, you know, conservative government in Canada that has taken a complete right turn from a whole generation of environmentalism there and is absolutely drill, baby, drill, right? So you can have a clear-eyed view of that, and you can disentangle from, you know, innocent childlike hopes about a benevolent parent that's going to take care of you. You can disentangle from that while being absolutely as influential and fierce and, you know, direct as ever. Okay, that's personal opinion. That's good. And I appreciate you bringing it up because it often does show up. And I think it's very interesting to think about people historically who really saw very clearly what they were dealing with, who simultaneously were very free in their relationship to it.
Can you give an example of that?
Oh, for example, I think of Gandhi. You know, he clearly saw through the British colonial, you know, we'll take care of you, just be poor, and you'll reincarnate happily next time. You know, he's like, I see right through that big, you know, and he caught them right where they were weak, you know, in terms of the British Empire wanting to look good. But when all those newsreels started showing up, those British soldiers and cops beating innocent people, wow, he had them because they never wanted to look bad. You know, it's said in certain countries that the worst thing you can do is embarrass us. You know what I mean? So, anyway, long story short. Okay, how about bringing it also back down to your personal life, like how this shows up? Yeah, great.
Your talk is truly amazing as far as what I've been going through.
You mean I'm not the only one that people kind of sometimes let down?
Yep. I have a situation where I have a 93-year-old mom, and I'm the primary caregiver, and I've set up a situation for her, thank God for the universe, just fitting in everything perfectly. She lives independently in San Francisco, and I have two brothers that I have been longing to get on the same page, and things have been just deteriorating, not to the point where they're not dependable, but where they want to destroy what I have set up for their own personal reasons. And it's not so much financial as it is, I don't know what it is. And through my practice, I got the message, just disengage. So that was the first message I got. And just tonight, I got disengage, while we were meditating, with love, compassion and wise speech, period. And that's all I can do. But there's a part of me that wants to know, you know, why? Why is somebody not only not dependable, but why would they want to rattle things? I mean, this is, and it's all a surprise, because I thought we're all going to be on the same page. I thought we're going to deal with mom, you know, all together.
Yeah.
And it's just unraveled over the last 10 months.
Right.
It's fascinating. And this whole thing of that you cannot depend.
Yeah.
No, that's exactly what's happening.
Well, thanks for that great example. And I want to just add something about that kind of situation. My father was in a situation very recently. He was discharged from the hospital into a care situation that everybody said, oh, you can depend on this. They said, oh, you can count on us. Just sign up. My dad's kind of befuddled. He's 96. He just got released. Sure, you seem really nice. You know, my dad's from North Dakota. He's used to trusting people. Sweet old guy. And next thing you know, they're doing all kinds of bad things, and we couldn't count on them. So part of the clear-eyed thing, I think, is to disentangle from our sometimes well-intended, deeply understandable, longing, but deluded fantasy about the good intentions or motivations or trustworthiness of the other party, or that they really, or, you know, they really are our friend rather than it's just business, you know, or even worse, and to realize that if we're going to get them to do what is needs to be done, we may need to marshal more resources or stack the contingencies or get out of the way of the karmic golf balls better so that suddenly their calculation of self-interest shifts. So sometimes what disentangling does is it makes us, helps us realize, wow, I need to bring more power to bear, more influence, more directness, I need to marshal resources, I need to get allies, I need to call a lawyer, I need to start creating a paper trail, I need them to know I'm starting to create a paper trail, I need to go on Yelp, you know what I mean? Whatever it might be, or say that I'm about to, you know, to ramp up. Because otherwise we're like, please, could I have another bowl? You know, like Oliver Twist, right? Maybe they're not really into giving you another bowl. Okay, a couple more people, then I better roll on. Yeah.
On the personal level, this, you know, you mentioned if self-interest, the word came up, the phrase came up, you mentioned. And a lot of people, you know, I'm around, they say, well, if I have something they want, or the power dynamic between us is such that I have something they want, they will be sure to attend enough not to be rude or indifferent or whatever, that they want me to be in the relationship to get something, you know, regardless whether it's a business thing or friendship or romance. And then we become kind of almost, you know, that's the school of power play. And I, you know, I'm so tired of dealing with that, with particularly with a lot of guys in the world of commerce. Transactions, and it seems to be more the way of how it is today in the world. And I idealistically hope for something different, yet I wonder, and I get naively delusional, as you were using the phrase. So to inspire somebody, if I have to work to make it seem like I have what they want, so to speak, then I'm entering this whole game. What is another way to inspire people to be accountable if that's how they play the game, which a lot of people do these days?
Yeah, how do we help other people? Well, that's a whole, I hope you'll come back next week. I will be here for the next 3 months, basically. Then I'll zip to Europe for 4 weeks, but then I'll be back again, but I'll be here. And I think there's one time in April I'm not here, but this is a huge topic. And one thing that happens is that it's funny when we're in this net, the Buddha used a lot of metaphors of disentanglement, disentangling, you know? When we're trapped in the net, often we feel kind of weirdly trapped, and we're in that, it's like a, we're playing tennis back and forth, and they hit it out of bounds and don't admit that they did, and We hit it back inbounds, hoping that our good behavior will somehow elicit good behavior from them, and it keeps going, going, going. There's a certain freedom when we suddenly go, I got it. I see what this movie is. I see what this script is. I get it now. I thought this was, you know, Father Knows Best, The Happy Family. No, this is like House of Cards. Right? It's like, whoop. And when you wake up like that, and it's a waking up from an internal spell, sometimes a spell that's quite skillfully cast by external players or cultural forces more broadly, you know. But when you kind of wake up from that, and you go through, I think, of the Kubler-Ross stages, you know. The first one is like denial and shock, and then anger, and then bargaining, and then despair, and then you finally get to serenity, where you go, I got it. That's it. It's the world. There's a lot of beautiful stuff about it. There's beautiful stuff in people that are not so reliable. I have options. I have resources. It's not perfect. I'm going to do what I can. Life is transient. You know, it's inevitable. Things change, right? That's the truth of it. But then you, I don't know, but like, I've lightened up a lot. It's like, wake up from the spell. And I want to use a really super technical, hardcore Buddhist term. Quit bullshitting, you know, yourself. Like this, it is what, it, you know, and then we got to deal with it. That's what I'm really talking about.
So we, just add on, I just realized I create my own disappointment. And I got to, if I can deal with, it's my disappointment about them, I'm going to be a lot freer.
Yeah, exactly right, exactly right. And it doesn't let them off the moral hook, and I'm not saying anything like that, I'm just saying, how do we practice with undependability in the largest sense? And as we wrap up here, I've got to wrap up. You know, so I'm dependable to end more or less on time. You know, how do we, right, find that which is more dependable? You know, okay, last person.
I think that, like he was saying about, it's about disentangling is about deeply accepting the other person and separating them from my longings and wishes. And to me, it doesn't really matter whether the person is malintended or whether they're just incapable because of whatever causes and conditions in their own lives of meeting my wishes. To deeply accept them means just to understand, oh, you couldn't meet my wishes for whatever set of reasons. I don't have to analyze them, because that's also strenuous.
Sure. Yeah, so what you're saying...
Just to accept that, oh, you didn't show up. Okay,
yeah.
Let me adjust how far forward I am.
Right. So you're saying, if I hear you, it may not be so necessary or perhaps not worth doing at all to try to sort through what their intentions are or who you are to them or things like that. And if that's true, okay. Yeah. I find for myself, though, it is helpful because a lot of what we do need to do is discern whether we can count on people for certain things and to form predictions about them that are reasonably accurate. And so there, it can help, I think, without going too far, to form some sort of take about or understanding of, you know, their value system or true intentions. You know, I got it that my bank could care less about me as a person. You know, they're not my friend. It's just business. They're not evil, but it's just business. But anyway, and now that I understand that, I'm adjusting my actions accordingly. Anyway. Okay, a lot of stuff. I want to end now. Sorry about that. I'm going to do it. How about we just sit with this, let it ripple, and consider your refuges for undependability. Okay.
Just to remind you, Tom is not here, about the two Donna baskets over here that accept overflowing cash.
Thank you.
People who haven't been here before.
I'm glad I called on you. Thank you. She's talking about if you'd like to make a donation. Thank you.
You have to shut me up, but I...
No, you're good, Nancy. I've learned no shutting you up. Anybody who's been here a long time knows that.
In the Donna basket.
All right. Oh, that's good. That's good. I like that.
And for everyone to turn your chairs around too, so we don't.
Oh yeah, that's right too. When we finish up here. Okay. So see if you can find the dependability of breathing and being. That's what to me Suzuki Roshi's talking about, really. Opening into like a child, this moment of mind altogether, breath after breath. Let's sit for a minute here. And to be clear, recognizing what is dependable about other people, especially some people, and institutions as well, and the world altogether. You know, in some ways, recognizing what's undependable really helps you be grateful for and respectful for and appreciative of what is dependable, including your own good heart. Thank you very much. I depend on all of you to be beautiful people, because you are.